hunters. There were many tales about them, but all agree that they were implacable in their hatred for all enemies of the holy faith. Lady Meriwether understood at once. Enemies such as Lord Stannis and his red sorceress, perhaps? Why, yes, as it happens, said Cersei, giggling like a girl. Shall we broach a flagon of Hippocras and drink to the fervour of the warrior sons on our way home? To the fervour of the warrior sons and the brilliance of the Queen Regent. To Cersei, the first of her name. The Hippocras was as sweet and savoury as Cersei's triumph, and the Queen's litter seemed almost to float back across the city. But at the base of Aegon's high hill, they encountered Margaery Tyrell and her cousins returning from a ride. She dogs me everywhere I go, Cersei thought with annoyance, when she laid eyes on the little queen. Behind Margaery came a long tail of courtiers, guards, and servants, many of them laden with baskets of fresh flowers. Each of her cousins had an admirer in thrall. The gangly squire, Alan Ambrose, rode with Eleanor, to whom he was betrothed. Sir Talad with Shy Alla, one-armed Mark Mullendore with Megha, plump and laughing. The Redwyn twins were escorting two of Margaery's other ladies, Meredith Crane and Jenna Fossoway. The women all wore flowers in their hair. Shalibar Zoe had attached himself to the party, too, as had Sir Lambert Turnberry with his eye patch, and the handsome singer known as the Blue Bard. And, of course, a knight of the King's Guard must accompany the little queen, and, of course, it is the Knight of Flowers. In white scale armour chased with gold, Sir Loras glittered. Though he no longer presumed to train Tommen at arms, the king still spent far too much time in his company. Every time the boy returned from an afternoon with his little wife, he had some new tale to tell about something that Sir Loras had said or done. Margaery hailed them when the two columns met and fell in beside the queen's litter. Her cheeks were flushed, her brown ringlets tumbling loosely about her shoulders, stirred by every puff of wind. "We have been picking autumn flowers in the King's Wood," she told them. "I know where you were," the Queen thought. Her informers were very good about keeping her apprised of Margaery's movements. Such a restless girl, our little Queen. She seldom let more than 3 days pass without going off for a ride. Some days they would ride along the Rusby Road to hunt for shells and eat beside the sea. Other times she would take her entourage across the river for an afternoon of hawking. The little queen was fond of going out in boats as well, sailing up and down the Blackwater Rush, to no particular purpose. When she was feeling pious, she would leave the castle to pray at Baylor's Sept. She gave her custom to a dozen different seamstresses, was well known amongst the city's goldsmiths, and had even been known to visit the fish market by the Mudgate for a look at the day's catch. Wherever she went, the small folk fawned on her, and Lady Margaery did all she could to fan their ardour. She was forever giving alms to beggars, buying hot pies off bakers' carts, and reining up to speak to common tradesmen. Had it been up to her, she would have had Tommen doing all these things as well. She was forever inviting him to accompany her and her hens on their adventures, and the boy was forever pleading with his mother for leave to go along. The Queen had given her consent a few times, if only to allow Sir Usney to spend a few more hours in Margaery's company. For all the good it has done, Usney has proved a grievous disappointment. "Do you remember the day your sister sailed for Dorne?" Cersei asked her son. "Do you recall the mob howling on our way back to the castle? The stones? The curses?" But the king was deaf to sense, thanks to his little queen.
"If we mingle with the commons, they will love us better."
"The mob loved the fat High Septon so well, they tore him limb from limb. And him a holy man," she reminded him. All it did was make him sullen with her. Just as Margaery wants, I wager. Every time, in every way, she tries to steal him from me. Geoffrey would have seen through her schemer smile and let her know her place, but Tommen was more gullible. She knew Joff was too strong for her, Cersei thought, remembering the gold coin Qyburn had found. For House Tyrell to hope to rule, he had to be removed. It came back to her that Margaery and her hideous grandmother had once plotted to marry Sansa Stark to the little queen's crippled brother, Willis. Lord Tywin had forestalled that by stealing a march on them and wedding Sansa to Tyrion, but the link had been there. They were all in it together, she realized with a start. The Tyrells bribed the jailers to free Tyrion and whisked him down the Rose Road to join his vile bride. By now the both of them are safe in Highgarden, hidden away behind a wall of roses.
You should have come with us, Your Grace,
the little schemer prattled on as they climbed the slope of Aegon's high hill.
We could have had such a lovely time together. The trees are garned in gold and red and orange, and there are flowers everywhere, chestnuts too. We roasted some on our way home.
I have no time for riding through the woods and picking flowers, Cersei said. I have a kingdom to rule.
Only one, Your Grace? Who rules the other six?
Margaery laughed a merry little laugh.
You will forgive me, my jest, I hope. I know what a burden you bear. You should let me share the load. There must be some things I could do to help you. It would put to rest all this talk that you and I are rivals for the king.
Is that what they say? Cersei smiled. How foolish! I've never looked upon you as a rival, not even for a moment.
Oh, I'm so pleased to hear that.
The girl did not seem to realize that she had been cut.
You and Tommen must come with us the next time. I know His Grace would love it. The Blue Bard played for us, and Sir Tallard showed us how to fight with a staff the way the small folk do. The woods are so beautiful in autumn.
My late husband loved the forest, too. In the early years of their marriage, Robert was forever employing her to hunt with him. But Cersei had always begged off. His hunting trips allowed her time with Jaime. Golden days and silver nights. It was a dangerous dance that they had danced, to be sure. Eyes and ears were everywhere within the Red Keep, and one could never be certain when Robert would return. Somehow the peril had only served to make their times together that much more thrilling. Still, beauty can sometimes mask deadly danger, she warned the little queen. Robert lost his life in the woods. Margaery smiled at Solaris, a sweet, sisterly smile, full of fondness.
Your Grace is kind to fear for me, but my brother keeps me well protected.
Go and hunt, Cersei had urged Robert half a hundred times. My brother keeps me well protected. She recalled what Taena had told her earlier, and a laugh came bursting from her lips.
Your Grace laughs so prettily.
Lady Margaery gave her a quizzical smile.
Might we share the jest?
You will, the Queen said. I promise you, you will. The Reaver. The drums were pounding out a battle beat as the Iron Victory swept forward, her ram cutting through the choppy green waters. The smaller ship ahead was turning, oars slapping at the sea. Roses streamed upon her banners, fore and aft a white rose upon a red escutcheon, atop her mast a golden one on a field as green as grass. The Iron Victory raked her side so hard that half the boarding party lost their feet. Oars snapped and splintered. Sweet music to the captain's ears. He vaulted over the gunwale, landing on the deck below with his golden cloak billowing behind him. The white roses drew back, as men always did at the sight of Victarion Greyjoy armed and armoured, his face hidden behind his kraken helm. They were clutching swords and spears and axes, but 9 of every 10 wore no armour, and the 10th had only a shirt of sewn scales.
These are no iron men, Victarion thought. They still fear drowning.
Get him! One man shouted. He's alone! Come! He roared back. Come! Kill me if you can! From all sides the rosy warriors converged, with grey steel in their hands and terror behind their eyes. Their fear was so ripe Victorian could taste it. Left and right he laid about, hewing off the first man's arm at the elbow, cleaving through the shoulder of the second. The third buried his own axe head in the soft pine of Victorian's shield. He slammed it into the fool's face, kicked him off his feet, and slew him when he tried to rise again. As he was struggling to free his axe from the dead man's ribcage, a spear jabbed him between the shoulder blades. It felt as though someone had slapped him on the back. Victorian spun and slammed his axe down onto the spearman's head, feeling the impact in his arm as the steel went crunching through helm and hair and skull. The man swayed for half a heartbeat, till the iron captain wrenched the steel free and sent his corpse staggering, loose-limbed across the deck, looking more drunk than dead. By then his ironborn had followed him down onto the deck of the broken longship. He heard Wolf One Ear let out a howl as he went to work, glimpsed Ragnar Pike in his rusted mail, saw Newt the barber send a throwing axe spinning through the air to catch a man in the chest. Victorian slew another man and another. He would have killed a third, but Ragnar cut him down first. "Well struck!" Victorian bellowed at him. When he turned to find the next victim for his axe, he spied the other captain across the deck. His white surcoat was spotted with blood and gore, but Victorian could make out the arms upon his breast, the white rose within its red escutcheon. The man bore the same device upon his shield, on a white field with a red embattled border. "You!" the iron captain called across the carnage. "Hugh of the Rose, be you the lord of South Shield?" The other raised his visor to show a beardless face. "His son and heir, Sir Talbot Serry. And who are you, Kraken?" "Your death," Victorian bawled toward him. Serry leapt to meet him. His long sword was good castle-forged steel, and the young knight made it sing. His first cut was low, and Victorian deflected it off his axe. His second caught the iron captain on the helm before he got his shield up. Victorian answered with a sidearm blow of his axe. Serry's shield got in the way. Wooden splinters flew, and the white rose split lengthwise with a sweet, sharp crack. The young knight's longsword hammered at his thigh once, twice, thrice, screaming against the steel. "This boy is quick," the iron captain realized. He smashed his shield in Serry's face and sent him staggering back against the gunwale. Victorian raised his axe and put all his weight behind his cut to open the boy from neck to groin. But Serry spun away. The axe head crushed through the rail, sending splinters flying, and lodged there when he tried to pull it free. The deck moved under his feet, and he stumbled to one knee. Sir Talbot cast away his broken shield and slashed down with his longsword. Victorian's own shield had twisted half around when he stumbled. He caught Serry's blade in an iron fist. Lobster steel crunched, and a stab of pain made him grunt. Yet Victorian held on.
"I'm as quick as well, boy," he said, as he ripped the sword from the knight's hand and flung it into the sea.
Sir Talbot's eyes went wide.
"My sword!"
Victorian caught the lad about the throat with a bloody fist.
"Go and get it," he said, forcing him backwards over the side into the blood-stained waters.
That won him a respite to pull his axe loose. The white roses were falling back before the iron tide. Some tried to flee below decks, as others cried for quarter. Victorian could feel warm blood trickling down his fingers beneath the mail and leather and lobstered plate. But that was nothing. Around the mast, a thick knot of foemen fought on, standing shoulder to shoulder in a ring.
"These few are men, at least. They would sooner die than yield."
Victorian would grant some of them that wish. He beat his axe against his shield and charged them. The drowned guard had not shaped Victorian Greyjoy to fight with words at King's Moots, nor struggle against furtive, sneaking foes in endless bogs. This was why he had been put on Earth, to stand steel-clad, with an axe red and dripping in his hand, dealing death with every blow. They hacked at him from front and back, but their swords might have been willow switches for all the harm they did him. No blade could cut through Victorian Greyjoy's heavy plate, nor did he give his foes the time to find the weak points at the joints, where only mail and leather warded him. Let three men assail him, or four, or five, it made no matter. He slew them, one at a time, trusting in his steel to protect him from the others. As each foe fell, he turned his wrath upon the next. The last man to face him must have been a smith. He had shoulders like a bull, and one much more muscular than the other. His armour was a studded brigandine and a cap of boiled leather. The only blow he landed completed the ruin of Victorian shield, but the cut the captain dealt in answer split his head in two.
Would that I could deal with a crow's eye as simply.
When he jerked his axe head free again, the smith's skull seemed to burst. Bone and blood and brain went everywhere, and the corpse fell forward up against his legs.
Ah, too late to plead for quarter now,
Victorian thought, as he untangled himself from the dead man. By then the deck was slick beneath his feet, and the dead and the dying lay in heaps on every side. He threw his shield away and sucked in air.
Lord Captain, he heard the barber say beside him, the day is ours.
All around the sea was full of ships. Some were burning, some were sinking, some had been smashed to splinters. Between the hulls the water was thick as stew, full of corpses, broken oars, and men clinging to the wreckage. In the distance, half a dozen Southron longships were racing back toward the Manda.
Ah, let them go, Victorian thought. Let them tell the tale.
Once a man had turned his tail and run from battle, he ceased to be a man. His eyes were stinging from the sweat that had run down into them during the fight. Two of his oarsmen helped him undo his kraken helm, so he might lift it off. Victorian mopped at his brow.
That night, he grumbled, the Knight of the White Rose, did any of you pull him out?
A lord's son would be worth a goodly ransom. From his father, if Lord Seri had survived the day. From his liege, at Highgarden, if not. None of his men had seen what became of the knight after he went over the side, however. Most like the man had drowned.
May he feast as he fought, in the drowned god's watery halls.
Though the men of the Shield Islands called themselves sailors, they crossed the seas in dread, and went lightly clad in battle for fear of drowning. Young Seri had been different.
A brave man, thought Victorian. Almost ironborn.
He gave the captured ship to Ragnar Pike, named a dozen men to crew her, and clambered back up unto his own iron victory.
Strip the captives of arms and armor, and have their wounds bound up, he told Newt the barber. Throw the dying into the sea. If any beg for mercy, cut their throats first.
He had only contempt for such. Better to drown on seawater than on blood.
I want a count of the ships we won, and all the knights and the lordlings we took captive. I want their banners, too.
One day he would hang them in his hall. So when he grew old and feeble, he could remember all the foes he had slain when he was young and strong.
It will be done, Newt grinned. It is a great victory.
Aye, he thought. A great victory for the Crow's Eye and his wizards. The other captains would shout his brother's name anew when the tidings reached Oakenshield. Euron had seduced them, with his glib tongue and smiling eye, and bound them to his cause with a plunder of half a hundred distant lands, gold and silver, ornate armour, curved swords with gilded pommels, daggers of Valyrian steel, striped tiger pelts, and the skins of spotted cats, jade manacores, and ancient Valyrian sphinxes, chests of nutmeg, cloves and saffron, ivory tusks and the horns of unicorns, green and orange and yellow feathers from the summer seas, bolts of fine silk and shimmering samite. And yet all that was little and less compared to this.
Now he has given them conquest, and they are his for good and all, the captain thought.
The taste was bitter on his tongue.
This was my victory, not his. Where was he? Back on Oakenshield, lazing in a castle? He stole my wife, and he stole my throne, and now he steals my glory.
Obedience came naturally to Victorian Greyjoy. He had been born to it. Growing to manhood in the shadows of his brothers, he had followed Balon dutifully in everything he did. Later, when Balon's sons were born, he had grown to accept that one day he would kneel to them as well, when one of them took his father's place upon the sea stone chair. But the drowned god had summoned Balon and his sons down to his watery halls, and Victorian could not call Euron king without tasting bile in his throat. The wind was freshening, and his thirst was raging. After a battle he always wanted wine. He gave the deck to Newt and went below. In his cramped cabin aft, he found the dusky woman wet and ready. Perhaps the battle had warmed her blood as well. He took her twice in quick succession. When they were done, there was blood smeared across her breasts and thighs and belly. But it was his blood, from the gash in his palm. The dusky woman washed it out for him with boiled vinegar.
"Ah, the plan was good, I grant him," Victorian said as she knelt beside him. "The Mander is open to us now, as it was of old."
It was a lazy river, wide and slow, and treacherous with snags and sandbars. Most sea-going vessels dare not sail beyond Highgarden, but long ships with their shallow draughts could navigate as far upstream as Bitterbridge. In ancient days the Ironborn had boldly sailed the river road and plundered all along the Mander and its vassal streams, until the kings of the Green Hand had armed the fisherfolk on the four small islands off the Mander's mouth and named them his shields. 2,000 years had passed, but in the watchtowers along the craggy shores, greybeards still kept the ancient vigil. At the first glimpse of longships, the old men would light their beacon fires, and the call would leap from hill to hill and island to island. "Fear! Foes! Raiders! Raiders!" When the fisherfolk saw the fires burning on the high places, they would put their nets and ploughs aside and take up their swords and axes. Their lords would rush from their castles, attended by their knights and men-at-arms. War horns would echo across the waters from Green Shield and Grey Shield, Oaken Shield and South Shield, and their long ships would come sliding out from moss-covered stone pens along the shores, oars flashing as they swarmed across the straits to seal the Mander and Hound and Harry the raiders upriver to their doom. Euron had sent Torvald Browntooth and the Red Oarsmen up the Mander with 12 swift longships, so the lords of the Shield Islands would spill forth in pursuit. By the time his main fleet arrived, only a handful of fighting men remained to defend the isles themselves. The Ironborn had come in on the evening tide, so the glare of the setting sun would keep them hidden from the greybeards in the watchtowers until it was too late. The wind was at their back, as it had been all the way down from Old Wyke. It was whispered about the fleet that Euron's wizards had much and more to do with it, that the crow's eye appeased the storm god with blood sacrifice. How else would he have dared sail so far to the west, instead of following the shoreline, as was the custom? The Ironborn ran their longships up unto the stony shingles and spilled out into the purple dusk with steel glimmering in their hands. By then the fires were burning in the high places, but few remained to take up arms. Grey Shield, Green Shield, and South Shield fell before the sun came up. Oaken Shield lasted half a day longer, and when the men of the four shields broke off their pursuit of Torvald and the Red Oarsmen and turned downriver, they found the Iron Fleet waiting at the Mander's mouth.
"All fell out as Euron said it would," Victorian told the dusky woman,
as she bound up his hand with linen.
His wizards must have seen it.
He had three aboard the Silence, Kellen Humble had confided in a whisper. Queer men and terrible they were, but the Crow's Eye had made them slaves.
"He still needs me to fight his battles, though,"
Victorian insisted.
"Wizards may be well and good, but blood and steel win wars."
The vinegar made his wound hurt worse than ever. He shoved the woman away and closed his fist, glowering.
"Bring me wine!"
He drank in the darkness, brooding on his brother.
"If I do not strike the blow with mine own hand, am I still a kin-slayer?"
Victorian feared no man, but the drowned god's curse gave him pause.
"If another strikes him down at my command, will his blood still stain my hands?"
Aaron Damfair would know the answer, but the priests were somewhere back on the Iron Islands, still hoping to raise the Ironborn against their new crown king.
"Newt the barber can shave a man with a thrown axe from 20 yards away, and none of Euron's mongrels could stand against Wolf One-Ear or Andric the Unsmiling. Any of them could do it."
But what a man can do, and what a man will do, are two different things, he knew.
"Euron's blasphemies will bring down the drowned god's wrath upon us all,"
Aaron had prophesied back on Old Wyke.
"We must cup him, brother. We are still of Balon's blood, are we not?"
"So is he," Victorian had said. "I like it no more than you, but Euron is the king. Your king's moot raised him up, and you put the driftwood crown upon his head yourself."
"I placed the crown upon his head," said the priest,
seaweed dripping in his hair.
"And gladly will I wrest it off again and crown you in his stead. Only you are strong enough to fight him."
"The drowned god raised him up," Victorian complained. "Let the drowned god cast him down."
Aaron gave him a baleful look, the look that had been known to sour wells and make women barren.
"It was not the god who spoke. Euron is known to keep wizards and foul sorcerers on that red ship of his. They send some spell amongst us, so we could not hear the sea. The captains and the kings were drunk with all this talk of dragons."
"Drunk and fearful of that horn. You heard the sound it made. It makes no matter. Euron is our king."
"Not mine," the priest declared. "The drowned god helps bold men, not those who cower below their decks when the storm is rising. If you will not bestir yourself to remove the crow's eye from the sea stone chair, I must take the task upon myself."
"How? You have no ships, no swords."
"I have my voice," the priest replied, "and the god is with me. Mine is the strength of the sea, a strength the crow's eye cannot hope to withstand. The waves may break upon the mountain, yet still they come, wave upon wave, and in the end only pebbles remain where once the mountain stood. And soon even the pebbles are swept away, to be ground beneath the sea for all eternity."
"Pebbles," Victorian grumbled. "You are mad if you think to bring the crow's eye down with talk of waves and pebbles."
"The Ironborn shall be waves," the Damfair said. "Not the great and lordly, but the simple folk, tillers of the soil and fishers of the sea. The captains and the kings raised Euron up, but the common folk shall tear him down. I shall go to Great Wyke, to Harlaw, to Orkmond, to Pike itself. In every town and village shall my words be heard. No godless man may sit the sea-stone chair."
He shook his shaggy head and stalked back out into the night. When the sun came up the next day, Aaron Greyjoy had vanished from Old Wyke. Even his drowned men knew not where. They said the cur's eye only laughed when he was told. But though the priest was gone, his dire warnings lingered. Victorian found himself remembering Baylor Blacktide's words as well.
Balon was mad. Aaron is madder. And Euron is maddest of them all.
The young lord had tried to sail home after the king's moot, refusing to accept Euron as his liege. But the Iron Fleet had closed the bay. The habit of obedience was rooted deep in Victorian Greyjoy, and Euron wore the Driftwood crown. Nightflyer was seized, Lord Blacktide delivered to the king in chains, Euron's mutes and mongrels had cut him into seven parts to feed the seven Greenland guards he worshipped. As a reward for his leal service, the new crown king had given Victorian the Dusky Woman, taken off some slaver bound for lease.
"I want none of your leavings,"
he had told his brother scornfully. But when the crow's eye said that the woman would be killed unless he took her, he had weakened. Her tongue had been torn out, but elsewise she was undamaged, and beautiful besides, with skin as brown as oiled teak. Yet sometimes when he looked at her, he found himself remembering the first woman his brother had given him to make a man of him. Victorian had wanted to use the Dusky Woman once again, but found himself unable.
"Fetch me another skin of wine," he told her, "then get out."
When she returned with a skin of sour red, the captain took it up on deck, where he could breathe the clean sea air. He drank half the skin and poured the rest into the sea for all the men who'd died. The Iron Victory lingered for hours off the mouth of the Mander. As the greater part of the Iron Fleet got under way for Oakenshield, Victorian kept Grief, Lord Dragon, Iron Wind, and Maiden's Bane about him as a rear guard. They pulled survivors from the sea and watched Hard Hand sink slowly, dragged under by the wreck she had rammed. By the time she vanished beneath the waters, Victorian had the count he'd asked for. He had lost 6 ships and captured 38.
"It will serve," he told Newt. "To the oars. We return to Lord Hewittstone."
His oarsmen bent their backs toward Oakenshield, and the Iron Captain went below decks once again.
"I could kill him," he told the Dusky Woman, "though it's a great sin to kill your king, and a worse one to kill your brother."
He frowned.
"Asha should have given me her voice. How could she have ever hoped to win the captains and the kings? Her with her pine cones and her turnips? Balin's blood is in her, but she's still a woman."
She had run after the king's moot, the night the Driftwood crown was placed on Euron's head. She and her crew had melted away. Some small part of Victorian was glad she had.
"If the girl keeps her wits about her, she will wed some northern lord and live with him in his castle, far from the sea and Euron Crow's Eye."
"Lord Hewittstone, Lord Captain!"
a crewman called. Victorian rose. The wine had dulled the throbbing in his hand. Perhaps he would have Hewitt's maester look at it if the man had not been killed. He returned to deck as they came around a headland. The way Lord Hewitt's castle sat above the harbour reminded him of Lordsport, though this town was twice as big. A score of longships prowled the waters beyond the port, the Golden Kraken writhing on their sails. Hundreds more were beached along the shingles and drawn up to the piers that lined the harbour. At a stone quay stood 3 great cogs and a dozen smaller ones, taking on plunder and provisions. Victorian gave orders for the Iron Victory to drop anchor.
"Have a boat made ready!"
The town seemed strangely still as they approached. Most of the shops and houses had been looted, as their smashed doors and broken shutters testified, but only the sept had been put to the torch. The streets were strewn with corpses, each with a small flock of carrion crows in attendance. A gang of sullen survivors moved amongst them, chasing off the blackbirds and tossing the dead into the back of a wagon for burial.
The notion filled Victorian with disgust. No true son of the sea would want to rot beneath the ground. How would he ever find the drowned god's watery halls to drink and feast for all eternity? The silence was amongst the ships they passed. Victorian's gaze was drawn to the iron figurehead at her prow, the mouthless maiden with the wind-blown hair and outstretched arm. Her mother-of-pearl eyes seemed to follow him.
She had a mouth like any other woman, till the crow's eye sewed it shut.
As they neared the shore, he noticed a line of women and children herded up onto the deck of one of the great cogs. Some had their hands bound behind their backs, and all wore loops of hemp and rope about their necks.
"Who are they?"
he asked the men who helped tie up their boat.
"Widows and orphans. They're to be sold as slaves."
"Sold?"
There were no slaves in the Iron Islands, only thralls. A thrall was bound to service, but he was not chattel. His children were born free, so long as they were given to the drowned god, and thralls were never bought nor sold for gold. A man paid the iron price for thralls, or else had none.
"There should be thralls, or salt wives,"
Victorian complained.
"It's by the king's decree,"
the man said.
"The strong have always taken from the weak," said Newt the barber. "Thralls or slaves, it makes no matter. Their men could not defend them, so now they are ours, to do with as we will."
"It is not the old way,"
he might have said, but there was no time. His victory had preceded him, and men were gathering round to offer congratulations. Victorian let them fawn, until one began to praise Urin's daring.
"It is daring to sail out of sight of land, so no word of our coming could reach these islands before us," he growled. "But crossing half the world to hunt for dragons, that's something else."
He did not wait for a reply, but shouldered through the press and on up to the keep. Lord Hewitt's castle was small but strong, with thick walls and studded oaken gates that evoked the house's ancient arms. An oak escutcheon, studded with iron upon a field of undy blue and white. But it was the Kraken of House Greyjoy that flew atop his green roof towers now, and they found the great gates burned and broken. On the ramparts walked Ironborn, with spears and axes, and some of Urin's mongrels too. In the yard, Victorian came on Gorrel Goodbrother, an old drum, speaking quietly with Roderick Harlaw. Newt the barber gave a hoot at the sight of them.
"Reader," he called out, "why is your face so long? Your misgivings were for naught. The day is ours, and ours the prize."
Lord Roderick's mouth puckered.
"These rocks, you mean? All four together wouldn't make Harlaw. We have won some stones and trees and trinkets, and the enmity of House Tyrell."
"The roses?" Newt laughed.
"What rose can harm the Krakens of the deep? We have taken their shields from them and smashed them to pieces. Who will protect them now?"
"High Garden," replied the reader. "Soon enough all the powers of the Reach will be marshalled against us, Barber, and then you may learn that some roses have steel thorns." Drum nodded, one hand on the hilt of his red rein.
"Lord Tarly bears the great sword Heartsbane, forged of Valyrian steel, and is always in Lord Tyrell's van."
Victorian's hunger flared.
"Let him come. I will take his sword for mine own, as your own forebear took Red Rain. Let them all come, and bring the Lannisters as well. A lion may be fierce enough on land, but at sea the Kraken rules supreme."
He would give half his teeth for the chance to try his axe against the Kingslayer or the Knight of Flowers. That was the sort of battle that he understood. The Kingslayer was accursed in the eyes of gods and men, but the warrior was honoured and revered.
"Have no fear, Lord Captain," said the reader. "They will come. His grace desires it. Why else would he have commanded us to let Hewitt's ravens fly?" "You read too much and fight too little," Newt said. "Your blood is milk."
But the reader made as if he had not heard. A riotous feast was in progress when Victorian entered the hall. Arnborn filled the tables, drinking and shouting and jostling each other, boasting of the men that they had slain, the deeds that they had done, the prizes they had won. Many were bedecked with plunder. Left-hand Lucas Cod and Kellen Humble had torn tapestries off the walls to serve as cloaks. German Butley wore a rope of pearls and garnets over his gilded Lannister breastplate. Andric the Unsmiling staggered by with a woman under each arm. Though he remained unsmiling, he had rings on every finger. Instead of trenchers carved from old stale bread, the captains were eating off solid silver platters. Newt the barber's face grew dark with anger as he looked about.
"The crow's eye sends us forth to face the longships, whilst his own men take the castles and the villages and grab all the loot and women. What has he left for us?"
"We have the glory."
"Glory is good," said Newt, "but gold is better."
Victorian shrugged.
"The crow's eye says we shall have all of Westeros, the Arbor, Old Town, Highgarden. That's where you'll find your gold. But enough talk, I'm hungry."
By right of blood, Victorian might have claimed a seat on the dais, but he did not care to eat with Euron and his creatures. Instead, he chose a place by Ralph the Limper, the captain of the Lord Kellen.
A great victory, Lord Captain," said the Limper. "A victory worthy of a lordship. You should have an island."
"Lord Victorian, aye, and why not?"
"It might not be the sea stone chair, but it would be something." Hutho Harlaw was across the table, sucking meat off a bone. He flicked it aside and hunched forward.
"The knight's to have Greyshield, my cousin, dear."
"No."
Victorian looked across the hall to where Sir Harris Harlaw sat drinking wine from a golden cup. A tall man, long-faced and austere.
"Why would Euron give that one an island?"
Hutho held out his empty wine cup, and a pale young woman in a gown of blue velvet and gilt lace refilled it for him.
"The knight took Gimston by himself. He planted his standard beneath the castle and defied the Grims to face him. One did, and then another, and another. He slew them all. Well, near enough, two yielded. When the seventh man went down, Lord Grim Septon decided the gods had spoken, and surrendered the castle."
Hutho laughed.
"He'll be the Lord of Greyshield, and welcome to it. With him gone, I am the Reader's heir."
He thumped the wine cup against his chest.
"Hutho, the humpback, Lord of Harlaw."
"Seven, you see."
Victorian wondered how Nightfall would fare against his axe. He had never fought a man armed with a Valyrian steel blade, though he had thrashed young Harris Harlaw many a time when both of them were young. As a boy, Harlaw had been fast friends with Balon's elder son, Roderick, who had died beneath the walls of Seagard. The feast was good, the wine was of the best, and there was roast ox, rare and bloody, and stuffed ducks as well, and buckets of fresh crabs. The serving wenches wore fine woolens and plush velvets, the Lord Captain did not fail to note. He took them for scullions dressed up in the clothes of Lady Hewitt and her ladies, until Hutho told him they were Lady Hewitt and her ladies. It amused the crow's eye to make them wait and poor. There were eight of them. Her ladyship herself, still handsome, though grown somewhat stout, and seven younger women, aged from 25 to 10, her daughters and good daughters. Lord Hewitt himself sat in his accustomed place upon the dais, dressed in all his heraldic finery. His arms and legs had been tied to his chair, and a huge white radish shoved between his teeth, so he could not speak, though he could see and hear. The crow's eye had claimed the place of honour at his lordship's right hand. A pretty buxom girl of 17 or 18 years was in his lap, barefoot and dishevelled, her arms around his neck.
"Who is that?"
Victorian asked the men around him.
"His lordship's bastard daughter," laughed Hutho. "Before Euron took the castle, she was made to wait at table on the rest, and take her own meals with the servants.
Urim put his blue lips to her throat, and the girl giggled and whispered something in his ear. Smiling, he kissed her throat again. Her white skin was covered with red marks where his mouth had been. They made a rosy necklace about her neck and shoulders. Another whisper in his ear, and this time the crow's eye laughed out loud, then slammed his wine cup down for silence. "Good ladies," he called out to his high-born serving women. "Falia is concerned for your fine gowns. She would not have them stained with grease and wine and dirty groping fingers, since I have promised that she may choose her own clothes from your wardrobes after the feast. So you had best disrobe." A roar of laughter washed over the great hall, and Lord Hewitt's face turned so red that Victorian thought his head might burst. The women had no choice but to obey. The youngest one cried a little, but her mother comforted her and helped her undo the laces down her back. Afterwards they continued to serve as before, moving along the tables with flagons full of wine to fill each empty cup, only now they did so naked.
"He shames Hewitt, as he once shamed me," the captain thought, remembering how his wife had subbed as he was beating her.
The men of the Four Shields oft married one another, he knew, just as the Ironborn did. One of these naked serving wenches might well be Sir Talbot Seri's wife. It was one thing to kill a foe, another to dishonour him. Victorian made a fist. His hand was bloody where his wound had soaked through the linen. On the dais, Euron pushed aside his slattern and climbed upon the table. The captains began to bang their cups and stamp their feet upon the floor. "Euron!" they shouted. "Euron! Euron! Euron!" It was King's Moot come again. "I swore to give you Westeros," the crow's eye said when the tumult died away. "And here is your first taste, a morsel, nothing more. But we shall feast before the fall of night." The torches along the walls were burning bright, and so was he, blue lips, blue eye, and all. "What the kraken grasps, it does not lose. These isles were once ours, and now they are again, but we need strong men to hold them. So rise, Sir Harris Harlaw, Lord of Greyshield." The knight stood, one hand upon Nightfall's moonstone pommel. "Rise, Andric the Unsmiling, Lord of Southshield." Andric shoved away his women and lurched to his feet, like a mountain rising sudden from the sea. "Rise, Baron Volmark, Lord of Greyshield." A beardless boy of 6 and 10 years, Volmark stood hesitantly, looking like the Lord of Rabbits. "And rise, Newt the Barber, Lord of Oakenshield." Newt's eyes grew wary, as if he feared he was the butt of some cruel jape. "A lord?" he croaked. Victorian had expected the crow's eye to give the lordships to his own creatures, Stonehand and the Red Oarsman, and Left-Hand Lucas Cod.
"A king must needs be open-handed," he tried to tell himself, but another voice whispered, "Euron's gifts are poisoned."
When he turned it over in his head, he saw it plain.
The knight was the reader's chosen heir, and Andric the Unsmiling, the strong right arm of Dunstan Drum. Volmark is a callow boy, but he has Blackharren's blood in him through his mother. And the barber,
Victorian grabbed him by the forearm,
"refuse him."
Newt looked at him as if he'd gone mad.
"Refuse him? Lands and lordship? Will you make me a lord?"
He wrenched his arm away and stood basking in the cheers.
"And now he steals my men away," Victorian thought.
King Euron called to Lady Hewitt for a fresh cup of wine and raised it high above his head.
"Captains and kings, lift your cups to the lords of the Four Shields."
Victorian drank with the rest.
"There is no wine so sweet as wine taken from a foe."
Someone had told him that once, his father or his brother Balon.
One day I shall drink your wine, Crow's Eye, and take from you all that you hold dear.
But was there anything Euron held dear?
On the morrow we plan once more to sail, the king was saying. Fill our casks anew with spring water. Take every sack of grain and cask of beef, and as many sheep and goats as we can carry. The wounded, who are still hale enough to pull an oar, will row. The rest shall remain here, to help hold these isles for their new lords. Torvald and the Red Oarsmen will soon be back with more provisions. Our decks will stink of pigs and chickens on the voyage east, but we'll return with dragons.
When? The voice was Lord Roderick's.
When shall we return, Your Grace? A year? 3 years? 5?
Your dragons are a world away, and autumn is upon us. The reader walked forward, sounding all the hazards.
Galleys guard the Red Wind Straits. The Dornish coast is dry and bleak. 400 leagues of whirlpools, cliffs, and hidden shoals, with hardly a safe landing anywhere. Beyond wait the Stepstones, with their storms and their nests of Lycine and Mearish pirates. If 1,000 ships set sail, 300 may reach the far side of the narrow sea. And then what? Lice will not welcome us, nor will Volantis. Where will you find fresh water, food? The first storm will scatter us across half the earth.
A smile played across Euron's blue lips.
I am the storm, my lord, the first storm and the last. I have taken the silence on longer voyages than this, and ones far more hazardous. Have you forgotten? I have sailed the smoking sea and seen Valyria.
Every man there knew that the doom still ruled Valyria. The very sea there boiled and smoked, and the land was overrun with demons. It was said that any sailor who so much as glimpsed the fiery mountains of Valyria rising above the waves would soon die a dreadful death. Yet the Crow's Eye had been there, and returned.
"Have you?"
the reader asked, so softly. Euron's blue smile vanished.
"Reader," he said into the quiet, "you would do well to keep your nose in your books."
Victorian could feel the unease in the hall. He pushed himself to his feet.
Brother, he boomed, you have not answered Harlow's questions.
Euron shrugged.
The price of slaves is rising. We will sell our slaves in Lys and Valentus. That and the plunder we have taken here will give us sufficient gold to buy provisions.
Are we slavers now?
Asked the reader.
And for what? Dragons that no man here has seen? Shall we chase some drunken sailor's fancy to the far ends of the earth?
His words drew mutters of assent.
Slavers be is too far, called out Rafe the Limper.
And too close to Valyria, shouted Kellan Humble. Freyleg the Strong said,
"I gardens close. I say, look for dragons there, the golden kind."
Arwen Sharp said,
"Why sail the world when the Mandor lies before us?"
Red Rafe Stonehouse bounded to his feet.
"Old Town is richer, and the arbour richer still. Redwind's fleet is off away. We need only reach out our hand to pluck the ripest fruit in Westeros."
"Fruit!" The king's eye looked more black than blue.
"Only a craven would steal the fruit when he could take the orchard."
"It's the arbour we want," said Red Rafe,
and other men took up the cry. The Crow's Eye let the shouts wash over him. Then he leapt down from the table, grabbed his slattern by the arm, and pulled her from the hall.
"Ha! Fled like a dog."
Euron's hold upon the sea stone chair suddenly did not seem as secure as it had a few moments before.
"And he will not follow him to Slaver's Bay. Perhaps they are not such dogs and fools as I had feared."
That was such a merry thought
that Victorian had to wash it down. He drained a cup with a barber to show him that he did not begrudge him his lordship, even if it came from Euron's hand. Outside, the sun went down. Darkness gathered beyond the walls, but inside the torches burned with a ruddy orange glow, and their smoke gathered under the rafters like a grey cloud. Drunken men began to dance the finger dance. At some point, left-hand Lucas Cod decided he wanted one of Lord Hewitt's daughters, so he took her on a table whilst her sisters screamed and sobbed. Victorian felt a tap upon his shoulder. One of Euron's mongrel sons stood behind him, a boy of 10 with woolly hair and skin the colour of mud.
"My father wishes words with you."
Victorian rose unsteadily. He was a big man with a large capacity for wine, but even so he had drunk too much.
I beat her to death with my own hands, he thought, but the crow's eye killed her when he shoved himself inside her. I had no choice.
He followed the bastard boy from the hall and up a winding stone stair. The sounds of rape and revelry diminished as they climbed, until there was only the soft scrape of boots on stone. The crow's eye had taken Lord Hewitt's bedchamber along with his bastard daughter. When he entered, the girl was sprawled naked on the bed, snoring softly. Euron stood by the window, drinking from a silver cup. He wore the sable cloak he took from Blacktide, his red leather eye patch, and nothing else.
"When I was a boy, I dreamt that I could fly," he announced. "When I woke, I couldn't. Or so the maester said. But what if he lied?"
Victorian could smell the sea through the open window, though the room stank of wine and blood and sex. The cold salt air helped to clear his head.
"What do you mean?"
Euron turned to face him, his bruised blue lips curled in a half-smile.
"Perhaps we can fly, all of us. How will we ever know, unless we leap from some tall tower?"
The wind came gusting through the window and stirred his sable cloak. There was something obscene and disturbing about his nakedness.
"No man ever truly knows what he can do unless he dares to leap."
"There is a window. Leap."
Victorian had no patience for this. His wounded hand was troubling him. "What you want?"
"The world."
Firelight glimmered in Euron's eye, his smiling eye.
"Will you take a cup of Lord Hewitt's wine? There's no wine half so sweet as wine taken from a beaten foe."
"No."
Victorian glanced away.
"Cover yourself."
Euron seated himself and gave his cloak a twitch, so it covered his private parts.
"I had forgotten what a small and noisy folk they are, my Ironborn. I would bring them dragons, and they shout out for grapes."
"Grapes are real. A man can gorge himself on grapes. Their juice is sweet, and they make wine. What do dragons make?"
"Whoa!"
The crow's eye sipped from his silver cup.
"I once held a dragon's egg in this hand, brother. The Myrish wizard swore he could hatch it if I gave him a year and all the gold that he required. When I grew bored with his excuses, I slew him. As he watched his entrails sliding through his fingers, he said, 'But it has not been a year.'" He laughed. "Crackhorn's died, you know."
"Who?"
"The man who blew my dragon horn. When the maester cut him open, his lungs were charred as black as soot."
Victorian shuddered.
"Show me this dragon's egg."
"I threw it in the sea during one of my dark moods."
Euron gave a shrug.
"It comes to me that the reader was not wrong. Too large a fleet could never hold together over such a distance. The voyage is too long, too perilous. Only our finest ships and crews could hope to sail to Slaver's Bay and back. The Iron Fleet."
"The Iron Fleet is mine,"
Victorian thought. He said nothing. The crow's eye filled two cups with a strange black wine that flowed as thick as honey.